You're listening to part two of Mudville at the Movies Top 10 Films of 2024. We released part one earlier in the week, in which we discussed numbers 6 through 10 on each of our respective lists. Ultimately, our conversation ran so long that we chose to upload it in two parts this year, instead of doing one long episode that would have approached about 3 hours in length. If you haven't heard that one yet, I highly recommend it. We talked about some very special movies that meant a lot to us and that we think you will enjoy as well if you have not seen them already. In this episode, you get the best of the best as we start at number 5 and make our way all the way down to our number 1 movies of the year. We talk about a wide array of films from all over the world, some made by do-it-yourself independent directors and others from some of the biggest filmmakers in the world. Tony and I had a great time talking about these, and we hope you enjoy. Tony, what is your number 5?
All right, my number 5 is Failed State by Chris Bell and Mitch Blummer. I've fallen in love with these two filmmakers, Chris Bell and Mitch Blummer. I believe they co-directed this film, and I think Mitch has been the DP on previous films of Chris's. And this film, you follow Dale Smith. Dale is a delivery man. He delivers packages, or he's contracted by a company. I don't even know how it works. It's a gray area, as is with modern society, and delivers packages to people all over New York City. Chris and Mitch have hired Dale as filmmakers. Dale is actually in real life a delivery man. He delivers packages, and he is what folks would say is a non-professional actor. And they collaborate with him on this film, which is kind of a slice of life and the toll that a modern day worker faces. This happens to be a delivery man. It's a grueling job. It's very time consuming, and it's not a whole lot of money. It doesn't come with any benefits. So you're really witnessing someone trying to persist through life in a system that's set up now more than ever, especially with wealth inequality, to make life as difficult and entrapping as possible. And so, yeah, Failed State. It's a very human film, and you can reach out to the director, Chris, or Mitch, and ask them for a link to this movie. It played at Spectacle for a week. It played at the Torino Film Festival, and it won Best Feature Film at the Bushwick Film Festival this year. So,
congratulations to them.
Yeah, 10 out of 10 movie. One of my favorite filmmakers, Chris Bell. And his collaborator and co-director of this film, Mitch Blummer, really put together a deeply human film. And the title is Failed State, of course, because how the state has failed us.
Absolutely. I am ashamed to say that I have not seen this one yet, especially because Chris and I are Twitter mutuals. I know you are as well. And
were you at the screening for The Winds That Scatter?
I was. I loved it. Yeah. So I need to watch this one. I wish I had done it before we recorded it, but I just wasn't able to. So I will be watching this in the weeks to come because I'm going to hit Chris up for a link as soon as I edit this and remember to do so.
Yeah. And feel free afterwards to chat with Chris and Mitch about the film afterwards, movies, politics, anything like that. They're great people. And then if you watch it, tell your friends about it.
Maybe we'll have them on the pod.
That'd yeah.
be sick.
And what's interesting, you bring up, so Chris had a film in 2017, 2018, I think, called The Winds That Scatter, which is another favorite film of mine. And The Winds That Scatter follows a Syrian immigrant in New Jersey trying to maintain and get employment. So it's very interesting that that is sort of a plot line in his film, The Winds That Scatter. And here in Failed State, we have someone who is employed. And both options are very oppressive. The system is very oppressive in both situations.
her Letterboxd, The Winds That Scatter was released in 2015.
15, which, okay.
The only reason I even mentioned that, I think it's even more impressive to have made and completed an independent film about a Syrian immigrant in 2015 than a couple years later when Donald Trump was in office and that was kind of more on people's minds. Like, you know, the fact that he was even ahead of that.
Right.
And, you know, I did see that one as well when you put it on, and I was really impressed by it. So Failed State is going to be on my list as well. And I will be watching Miss Me Yet as well, which you put on your list last year. So,
right.
Yeah.
I've Miss got Me a lot Yet, to you learn. Can watch for free on Means TV.
Will do.
And one more thing. If you want to check out the film, you can reach out to Chris. He's on Twitter or X, the Everything app.
Twitter.
He's also on Blue Sky at Update the Grids on Twitter. And I think it's the same on Blue Sky, but it could also just be Chris Bell dot Blue Sky, however they do it over there.
All right.
Well, what's your number five?
Number five for me, I'm sticking with the trend of, you know, homemade independent filmmakers that...
Oh, that's wonderful that they're both number five.
So. Yeah, I think it's great. This is a guy that I have championed on the podcast a few times now. We had him on as a guest last year to discuss his movie, Heard She Got Murdered. He has released a movie, at least one movie, every year so far since 2021, I believe. That is Matt Farley of Moturn Media with his collaborative partner Charlie Roxburgh, who directs most of Matt Farley's movies, but this one, titled Local Legends Bloodbath, is directed by Matt Farley himself, as was Local Legends, the original that came out in 2013. Which, if you guys remember, I discussed on my favorite first watches of last year. We talked about this one about a year ago. And if you remember, we also did an episode on Local Legends Bloodbath already. So I won't go too deep into that. If you want our more extended thoughts on that, I will put the link to that episode in there as well. I think it's pretty impressive that Matt decided to even do a sequel to Local Legends at all, you know, given how much praise was sort of showered onto him for making that.
Yeah, it kind of stands out critically from the rest of his films, even though people have a positive view on all of his work, I would say.
I think so.
He has his own community of diehard stans, but people go out of their way to be like, oh, but if there's one... It's Local Legends.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it sort of depends on who you ask. If you're talking to people who are really more like interested in what exactly he does and like who he is and how that process plays out, it's absolutely going to be Local Legends that they point to. If it's someone who's more like a fan of the like genre type movies and is like just more impressed by like the actual technical sort of prowess of what it's like to, you know, cast your friends in a movie and like hire your boss to be like, hey, you want to be in this movie I'm shooting this weekend? And then, you know, have it play out as a nice like monster movie that is really funny as hell as well. I mean, I feel like the comedic aspects of some of these can tend to be undersold just because of how miraculous it is that he's been able to do this for so long. But I feel like other people might point to Don't Let the River Beast Get You, which, I mean, I love both of those. They serve very different purposes, but I think if you kind of watch them in tandem, you get the full experience of what Matt Farley has been trying to do for a long time. Sort of his recent output with like Magic Spot, Heard She Got Married, Heard She Got Murdered, those were a little bit more like serious type movies and were more conceptual and in some cases kind of played out more like in earnest, as opposed to, you know, some of the more kind of stilted dialogue that you see in like Don't Let the River Beast Get You, which I believe is now 12-13 years old. I think that one came out in 2012. So Matt's project has been sort of evolving, I think, ever since then. And this one really took a big step in that direction as well, just because, you know, it's 10 years after the first movie, a little more than that, actually. And like the independent upstart artist who was praised so much for being able to depict what his life is like and what it's like to be able to do this and the sacrifices he has to make in order to complete some of these films and be able to get everybody in the same place at the same time, you know, is now seen fictionally as this selfish and maligned figure around his community
who is at risk of permanently alienating everybody around him, and who the business side of his persona ends up even going around and killing at the end of the movie. Matt told us a little bit about this when he came onto the podcast a little bit over a year ago, and he described it as a slasher sequel to Local Legends, and I was like, I have no idea what that's going to look like, but it sounds sick. And I can confirm it's really, really cool. So it's a really fun experience, even if you've never seen any of Matt Farley's work, but it's an even richer text if you are aware of Local Legends and Don't Let the River Beast Get You.
So you'd recommend all three?
I'd recommend everything that I've seen. I haven't seen all of his work. I haven't seen like Slingshot Cops yet, or Murder Monsters in Manch Vegas. I'm butchering that title, but of the ones that I have seen, I mean, I've loved
Vegas
all of it.
Manch Vegas is the chicken tender capital of the world.
Is it? I didn't. That's sick. But
Manchester, New Hampshire.
Yeah, local upstart homemade filmmaker based in Danvers, Massachusetts.
Shout out Danvers. Shout out North Shore.
Everything Matt puts out, I'm going to support. I'll talk about on this podcast. And I look forward to Evil Puddle. So, Matt, if you're hearing this, keep up the good work, man.
Is Evil Puddle coming out this year?
I think so.
I haven't seen it on the most anticipated film list from IndieWire or Filmstage. Well,
those guys are fucking up then.
I haven't even looked at their list.
Yeah,
fair enough. I don't know if it'll be there,
maybe,
but I hope they are. The 50, yeah.
Two great independent filmmakers, Chris Bell, Matt Farley. Love those guys. What's your number four?
My number four is No Other Land, a documentary from Palestine. It's directed by Basil Adra, Hamdan Bilal, Yuval Abraham, and Rachel Zor. This film won Best Documentary Film at the 74th Berlin Film Festival. It has won many awards all over the globe, and yet it won Best Nonfiction Film of the New York Critics Circle, National Board of Review, Best Film, Best Documentary Feature at the Gothams. It's picked up just about every award you could think of in an award season, and yet in the United States, there was no distribution for some strange reason.
Huh. I wonder why.
Yeah, so the film is about a Palestinian activist named Basil Adra, who has been resisting forced displacement by Israeli's military. It takes place in the West Bank in the village of Masafer Yatta. And it's been, it's sort of like a gradual destruction of this village and these Palestinians who have been there for generations and generations and generations in order to create a military zone. Now, that is sort of what is said is going to be. So it's like they're going to kick people out, bulldoze their homes, give them no place to remove to, just to leave all of Palestine so that Israel and their Zionist army can have a shooting zone, basically, to practice silly exercises, or it could also be a place where settlers come and take over and settle. And so the film is about Basil and his family, Basil comes from a history of activism, of activists. His father is a massive activist, and it's about that, their interactions with the occupying Israel army. But one of the more haunting aspects is his relationship with the journalist Yuval Abraham, who is also a co-director on the film. Basil is also a co-director, and Yuval is Jewish and Israeli, and therefore he can walk freely and navigate freely throughout the entire country. And so you're looking and seeing two human beings under completely two different systems of rule, and they're living in the same space. And it's all because of one's ethnicity. So it's a real gut punch of a film, I have to say. So 2 days ago, despite the fact that it didn't get any U.S. distribution, it did get nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary, and it opens up at screenings at Film Forum on January 31st. So that is, if you're in New York City, please, please, please buy a ticket. I think it's worth it. 2 days after No Other Land, so today, was nominated for an Oscar. Donald Trump this week has lifted sanctions on settlers in Israel. And so for those of you who don't know, the Zionist philosophy is to settle and conquer all of the Middle East, starting with Palestine, then moving into Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, is to cleanse the whole area of Arabs, Muslims, and Christians, and Jews aren't quite on the same level, but they get a little better privileges. That is sort of like the very kind of extreme end of a ethno-supremacist belief system. And so 2 days after it was nominated for an Oscar, sanctions, Biden had sanctions on settlers, being like, if you are a settler, like, you'll lose your American passport or whatever, other sanctions, blah, blah, blah. Trump lifted those sanctions, and so settlers have invaded Masafer Yatta again and started burning and breaking down homes. You'll see settlers doing that and the Zionist occupying army do that in the film as well. But they're doing it now as we speak with this podcast. And so, yeah, don't be silent about this. It's pretty fucking crazy. See No Other Land. If you haven't seen the film, do whatever you can to find it. Maybe it'll open up to other screenings throughout the country. And settlers, dude, holy shit. I don't know if people know what settlers are. I just explained what they are, but to see it depicted in this film is, it's straight out of a horror movie, but it's real fucking life, and it's happening right now as we speak. So, yeah, No Other Land is my fourth film.
The fact that there's still no U.S. distribution for this is incredibly damning. Yeah. Like, and I mean, in terms of a documentary that is talking about something relevant and necessary, especially when you're American and your tax dollars are going to funding this on a day-to-day basis, I mean, it doesn't get more necessary than this. So
it is interesting that it got an Oscar nom.
I'm surprised that it did.
There are obviously bigger issues than the Oscars right now. Yeah. And even it is interesting that the Academy said yes to this film, especially since there was another Palestinian film that was shortlisted, that had a lot of film business people backing it as producers, but that didn't make the cut. This film did. And one, I don't have any Oscar takes, but I will say it's very interesting that the last two Oscars, the 2022 Oscars, the best documentary winner was Navalny, the Russian film, and in 2023, about the guy who is, Navalny is the guy who is running against Putin.
Right.
And then in 2023 was 20 Days in Mariupol in Ukraine. So we're seeing 2 years in a row on the subject, the same subject of Russia-Ukraine relations. And this year, another documentary, Porcelain War, which won Best Documentary at Sundance, also made the nominations list. So with No Other Land, Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat is part of this. But I wonder if Porcelain War will make it a three-peat for the subject of the Oscars on Russia-Ukraine relations.
I wouldn't could be something surprised.
It could be something that the Academy is really passionate about. I don't know if there's been a three-peat on the same subject quite like this.
They do seem to be quite passionate about Russia and Ukraine, and equally silent about Israel-Palestine. Everything you said about, you know, if people out there, even the listeners of this podcast, aren't quite aware of some of the more maddening and destructive details of what Israeli settlers have done in Gaza, and that they're starting to do in the West Bank as well, it's truly horrifying. So if we can find more films like this, find more media that is willing to tackle that subject matter, I think especially as Americans, we have a responsibility to go and seek that out. I will certainly be supporting No Other Land during its run at Film Forum. I have not been able to see it yet, partially because it does not have any U.S. distribution, which, like I said, is an incredibly damning fact for the state of distribution in this country.
For sure.
Brady Corbet, even the director of The Brutalist, ended his acceptance speech for Best Director with, "It's time to distribute No Other Land." part of the reason why I am a little bit more confident in my reading of his film. But yeah, it is going to be incredibly lucrative that people see this, that people see other work from Palestinian filmmakers, whether it be these folks or others, especially now that Gaza is essentially in ruins. It's going to be very difficult for work to even be made, to be shown and distributed here, especially. It's all just such a mess, and anything we can do to try to raise awareness of it, either our own awareness or people who haven't sought it out, either for reasons of like ignorance or just willful blindness, I can't echo that enough. So I'm glad that you were able to put it on your list. I think if I'd seen it, I probably would have done the same, but yeah, I have not been able to watch this yet.
And then one other thing too, in terms of like distribution, can you see this? Definitely try and find it. Call your local theater to see if they can play it. That could work as well. But also, if you Google Palestinian Film Archive on Twitter, on Google, a bunch of different places, you can see a lot of Palestinian films for free online. Just, you know, ask around.
I'm going to link that as well in the description. So if cool. You're interested in seeing more of that, scroll down below. Number four for me. Evil does not exist. Ryosuke Hamaguchi.
Hamaguchi.
I would say there is no filmmaker, with the possible exceptions of maybe Matt Farley, who we just discussed, Hong Sang-soo, or John Boyce, who is having a better decade thus far than Ryosuke Hamaguchi.
Wow. John Boyce in the same
hell yeah, he
vein as Hamaguchi.
He deserves it. In fact, Drive My Car and Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, both releasing in 2022, is sort of an arbitrary measuring stick, but I think it's more impressive than Spielberg's notorious 1993 with Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. I prefer both of those movies to both of the Spielberg movies. Sort of a drive-by at Steven there, my bad. But I've been feeling lately like a rewatch of Drive My Car is in the cards for me, since I do think it's one of the best films to be released this decade. And when I saw it in a theater, just letting it wash over me was an incredibly poetic experience. And his follow-up to an incredible 2022 is this film, Evil Does Not Exist. It is about the residents of a small village near Tokyo, particularly a man named Takumi, a man who spends his days in touch with nature, chopping wood, foraging for plants, and spending time with his daughter Hannah, who accompanies him a lot of the time and seems to have some sort of deeper connection herself with some of the wildlife in the area. And the townspeople are made aware of this corporation's plan to install a glamping site in the village. And if you don't know what glamping is, it's shorthand for glamorous camping. And in effect, the plan would siphon the town's resources to give rich tourists an all-encompassing vacation experience, and would taint the town's water supply and render it unlivable for most people. And in one of the most memorable and maddening scenes of the year, the townspeople meet with representatives of the glamping company to explain why their plan is nonsense and cannot be put into effect. And crucially, the representatives are not the executives in charge of the plan who have come up with this plan. They are lower level PR employees who are actually convinced by the townspeople and who end up realizing they're making a lot of strong points and that the plan that has been developed is not feasible. They take these notes back to their boss, who essentially says to them, "This is going to happen one way or another. If we are not the company to take advantage of this opportunity, someone else will. And if someone's going to make a bunch of money, why shouldn't it be us?" So the PR people go back to the town, and one of them starts accompanying Takumi on his day-to-day tasks. He is comically inept at even chopping a block of wood. From that point, the movie takes a very sharp turn as Takumi's daughter Hannah goes missing, and one character at one point is violently attacked by another. But without spoiling too much of the movie, a lot of things are left ambiguous or up to the viewer's interpretation. This is the movie that I was talking about a little bit earlier on my list that I think deals with a lot of the same questions as Seed of the Sacred Fig, where when you're talking about, you know, in a vacuum, how one person sees their job and the task that they're paid to perform. And then when you go back and you look at that in the greater context of the town and the country and the world around you, how you are tangibly affecting other people's lives, the effect that can have on you. When you just make a little bit of effort to go and challenge the system a little bit, it can be incredibly telling how that system reacts to you. And I think the title Evil Does Not Exist is sort of ambiguous in that same way, because it's very easy to take away from this movie that evil very much does exist, and it's in the hearts of the capitalist businessmen who are racing to destroy this village and drive all of its residents away so that they can create a spot for rich Japanese tourists. But the movie slowly draws out the process of showing us that there is no direct line of communication between the villagers and the executives who are plotting to ruin their lives. The power structure has been designed in such a way that every one person just feels like they're doing what they're paid to do. And if injustices do end up occurring, the reasoning for that can always be passed on to someone else. The PR employees are passing on their own guilt to the executives, and the executives are passing on the blame to these other hypothetical companies who would apparently take advantage of the location and do what this company is planning to do if they say, okay, this is an unfeasible plan, we're not going to do it. So evil does not exist in the hearts of men who think that they're just doing what they're paid to do. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch this again. I think this is one that would certainly benefit from being seen a second time around. You know, you get this opening shot of just passing through the trees and this incredible score by Eiko Ishibashi, which has stuck with me throughout the year. And Hamaguchi now has made 3 films this decade. If you're counting, it's Drive My Car, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, and now Evil Does Not Exist, which have been among my very favorites of the past few years. So he is a filmmaker who, whatever he makes next, I'm going to show up for that and I'm going to support that, because I think he's doing some truly incredible work.
There's actually another film that came out this year called The Gift, which is what he originally set out to make. What is the composer's name?
Eiko Ishibashi.
So she came up with a score, and Hamaguchi was asked to create a film to go along with the score, and that became The Gift. It's a silent film. And then his work on The Gift kind of then kept going and manifesting itself into another film with the same score called Evil Does Not Exist. And The Gift was performed sporadically this year at Lincoln Center at the New York Film Festival, and then I believe this past spring, like a one night only thing. Tough luck if you didn't get a ticket. I didn't, with a full orchestra. So another wrinkle to that film is that there's another one out there.
Interesting. I didn't even know that. What's your number 3? We're getting into the top 3 here.
All right, people. This is A Different Man by Aaron Schimberg. Stars Sebastian Stan, Renata Renzeev, and the legendary Adam Pearson. Man, where do I even begin with this film? The film is about a guy named Edward Lemuel? What? How do you pronounce his last name?
I have no idea.
I'm so bad at this. See?
Just call him Edward. That's all.
But he's a struggling actor with neurofibromatosis. And he meets with a doctor who's in a medical test trial to possibly cure his neurofibromatosis. And what I like about this film, it's extremely funny. You're not sure where the film's going to go in the first half. And then all of a sudden, with the appearance of Adam Pearson, the film shifts gears in such a funny, affirming way. And it challenges a lot of preconceived notions and prejudices of the audience that is watching it. So shout out Aaron Schimberg, Adam Pearson, Sebastian Stan, and Renata Renzeev. I had a laugh out loud time with this film.
I think this is one of the best movies of the year as well. Like I said, it was on my honorable mentions at the top of the show. We talked about it a little bit on the podcast because Brody worked on this movie. He was part of the crew.
Congrats, Brody.
It was a lot of fun, yeah. So he's been, I know, having a really fun time sort of watching it be nominated at the festival circuit. Just got an Oscar nomination, I believe, for
Makeup
Sebastian
and Hairstyle.
Stan. Or
no,
was he nominated for The Apprentice?
He was nominated for The Apprentice, the wrong film.
Well,
you know,
might as well have been
there's
this one.
You know Leo McCarey?
Yeah.
He's a famous studio filmmaker in the 30s and 40s. He directed all the Marx Brother films.
Famously not the chief of staff from The West Wing.
Yes, famously not that. But he came out with two films one year. One was called The Awful Truth, which he won Best Director for at the Academy Awards. In that same year, he made a film called Make Way for Tomorrow, which then served as the basis for Ozu's Tokyo Story. He based it off of that. And so Make Way for Tomorrow, The Awful Truth came out the same year. The Awful Truth was nominated for a bunch of Oscars and gave Leo McCarey Best Director. And the legend has it, when he got up on stage, I can't find footage of it for some reason, but when he got up on stage to accept the award, he said, "Thank you very much, but you've awarded me for the wrong film." So actually, while Sebastian Stan gives an impressive performance in The Apprentice,
he's much better in this one.
I gotta lean more towards A Different Man. He really digs deep in it.
Yeah, I mean, this is an incredible movie because it's kind of told in two different parts. Like you said, in the first part, Sebastian Stan's character, Edward, is suffering from this extremely rare condition. He's able to get this experimental surgery. I sort of talked about this already last week when I was talking about Seconds by John Frankenheimer, that film that was one of my favorite first watches of 2024. This one has a lot of similarities to that, but when he's able to fix the condition and he's able to get this surgery that turns him into a man that looks like Sebastian Stan, he pretends that Edward is dead and he says that he is an entirely new person, only to find that Adam Pearson's character Oswald, who of course Adam Pearson actually has this condition in real life, and he's an actor who has made a career despite that, he shows up and he's just like the fucking Riz King, and he's got swag. Yeah. And he steals Edward's girl because Ingrid of course thinks that Edward is already dead, so she goes on with putting on this show that she has written about quote-unquote Edward, and Oswald gets the lead role because, of course, he is an actor with this condition in real life. And Oswald just lives his life exactly how Edward wasn't living his. You know, Edward was somebody who assumed that because of his condition, you know, people wouldn't take him seriously and they wouldn't accept him, only to find that when Oswald comes out and he's just this confident guy who everybody likes and who people accept and who they listen to him sing with a smile on their face and they applaud him and everything, it's only then that Edward realizes that it's him, and it's him on the inside, which was his problem all along. And so the fact that he's gotten this surgery is not going to fix his problems. And I'll sort of leave it there in terms of the plot, but this is a totally original film. I mean, despite the fact that I've compared it so many times to Seconds, you know, I really haven't seen much else like this. And it really is a truly singular performance from Sebastian Stan, who I think you're right. I think they nominated him for the wrong movie and they totally fucked up by not nominating Adam Pearson in supporting actor, because his performance is what makes this movie work alongside Sebastian Stan's.
Yeah, and I would say he gives such a dynamite performance that's on par with, I know, a very dynamite actor, Kieran Culkin.
Yes.
I think just in terms of, what's the word, a tornado, tour de force presence in the film, I think Adam Pearson gives one as well.
Absolutely. Want to move on to my number three?
Give it to me.
Okay. Number three for me is I Saw the TV Glow by Jane Scheinbrunn. This spent a good 6 months for me, rivaling what ended up being my favorite release of 2024. And I was all but certain that this would land a spot in the top two until the very next movie on the list came around and changed all that for me and really blew me away. I saw The TV Glow is a movie about two characters, Owen / Isabel, portrayed by Justice Smith, and Maddie, portrayed by Jack Haven. Maddie is a few years older than Owen and introduces him to a show called The Pink Opaque, which is on late at night that they have to sneak around their parents, particularly Maddie's abusive stepdad, in order to watch together. And Maddie starts leaving VHS tapes around the school for Owen to find with descriptions of the episodes, and they both develop a relationship to the show that risks consuming their entire lives. And you can't talk about this movie without a massive part of the conversation being about the fact that the film, particularly its second half, acts as an allegory for gender transition and the fear that trans people have of shedding one identity for the one that is truly theirs. And Jane Scheinbrunn is non-binary, and they employ this in such a way that has helped so many viewers come to terms with their own identity already, while already feeling universal enough that I was able to connect with it and didn't feel at all like this was made for someone else, even if it sort of technically was. And I've seen some people miss that allegory entirely, which I think is a little bit silly or just willfully blind and coming from a place of discomfort. But this strikes me as a very important film. It captures the feeling of nostalgia for the TV shows that you watched as a kid, particularly for the millennial generation, which is a few years before me. And it does that as well as anything that I have seen. You know, that's a bit of a two-sided coin, because while a lot of media treats nostalgia as, you know, remember the good old days when everything was perfect, this treats The Pink Opaque as something much more sinister and even misremembered by the characters. And Owen goes back to watch it when he's older, and it isn't anything like he remembered. And, you know, without giving away too many details, he bypasses a very important opportunity in the third act of the film. And the result of that and what he's left with in his own life is incredibly haunting. And not only is this like a singular film in terms of its subject matter and the way that it deploys millennial nostalgia, but also just on an aesthetic basis, like the amount of production design that's given to the fictional show, The Pink Opaque, is incredible. And the amount of time that is given to like musical performances that are entirely separate from the plot itself reminded me a lot of like the Roadhouse scenes in Twin Peaks: The Return. And that really is the highest compliment that I can give a work of art. I mean, I felt that influence the whole time that I was watching this movie, just like I did with another one that's going to be one of the top two on my list. It really is one of two films that made me believe that Twin Peaks: The Return laid the groundwork for the next generation of great filmmakers. And I left the theater enraptured and inspired, and I can't wait for what Jane Scheinbrunn does next. But that's my number three.
Me too. My number two.
Let's do it. Top two.
Dahomey.
I saw this one.
Directed by Matty Diop.
Yes.
This film is a documentary about, blends in a little bit of fiction, but it is mostly a documentary about the museum in France that is returning 37 artifacts. I'm sorry, 26 artifacts that were stolen from the country Benin. And during the French colonial rule of the time. And finally, 26 items are being returned to the country that they were stolen from, Benin. And one of the cool wrinkles in the film is that as you're watching the process of these artifacts being returned, one of the artifacts, the statue of King Gezo, serves as a narrator. And it's a voiceover by a Haitian writer, Mackenzie Orcel, and it gives voice to one of the artifacts as it's making its journey back to the country of Benin. That's one element. And then one of the more thrilling scenes of the year is the opening of the film and a congress of college students discussing what it means to have 26 objects back. What does it mean in terms of reparations, decolonization, colonization? Does it fully heal things? The museum has hundreds, if not thousands, of artifacts that they still have not returned. So why is it only 26 that were chosen to return? And you are being presented with a wide variety of views, and it is incredibly stimulating discourse. And you see the trauma and pain of colonization and how it affects people for generations to come.
Yeah, I saw this one as well. It impressed me as well. I mean, it didn't quite make my list, but I was particularly struck by some of the scenes in which they were having like a town hall. It seemed
that was
like,
it, yeah.
Yeah, to discuss, you know, what to do with these artifacts, given that the ancient kingdom that they were looted from no longer exists.
Mm.
You know, who should have the rights to claim these artifacts? What should be done with them? And sort of more importantly, what is to be done with the rest of the artifacts? Because they only send 26 of them back, but there are like hundreds more that are still being kept
right
by the people that originally looted them so long ago.
Right.
And so I think it like raises a lot of important questions. One that the filmmakers don't really try to answer, maybe because there is no clear answer to them. Like, I was not aware of this really at all. So, like, for a filmmaker like Madi Diop, who her reputation preceded her, you know, I saw, I believe, the last film that she released. It's Atlantics. Yeah, that's what it was. I think it's very cool that she's, you know, raising these questions and giving the space of the discussion to the folks who have been directly impacted by them. So, I agree that, you know, especially with some of the voiceovers being employed, she goes about it in a particularly unique way as well. So I'm with you here. This one gets a thumbs up from me as well.
Two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up.
R.I.P. Siskel and Ebert.
All right. Number two on my list. There were 2 5-star films for me released in 2024.
Wow. I give 5 stars to everything.
I know you do. I do. It's totally like an arbitrary process. I do 5 stars for stuff that like it truly strikes me as something that I will never forget, something that like advances cinema as an art form, or something that I just think is executed to perfection.
Mm.
Like I said, it's pretty arbitrary.
I take a more whose line is it anyway approach on Letterboxd.
You just give everything 5.
Everything is made up and the points don't matter. So
yeah, there you go.
Even if I don't give, I usually give something 5 stars or I don't have stars for it. And that just could mean a variety of different things. It means I liked it. I didn't like it. I don't have my mind made up on it. I don't have any thoughts immediately after seeing it. So I have a more whose line is it anyway approach.
Sure. Number 2 for me. Nickel Boys by Ramel Ross.
Did you see this in cinema?
I did.
Nice.
Oh my God, it was amazing. This might end up being the best American film of this decade. Ramel Ross adapts Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer-winning novel by putting the viewer in the mind of our protagonist, Elwood, through first-person point-of-view camera work as we see the first images of his childhood, the grass he lies in, the foliage all around him. We meet his family, and we can immediately recognize the love and the admiration that they have for him. It just feels also deeply human. That's a pretty shallow critique, but when you watch the movie, I think you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. We hitch a ride with him as he unknowingly gets into a stolen car. With very little dialogue, we infer what happens next to him and the injustice that is inflicted upon him because of his race. And it's only when he's taken to Nickel Academy and meets Turner, who is sort of the other protagonist of this movie, that the point of view changes and we meet Elwood through Turner's eyes. Now, Nickel Academy is based on a real school, the Dozier School for Boys in the Florida Panhandle, where young black boys were ripped away from their families and sentenced to for decades. The school operated for over a century and developed a reputation for students being abused, beaten, even raped and murdered by the staff.
And in 2012, it was discovered that 55 bodies had been buried underneath school grounds, and as many as 100 children were murdered there. These same discoveries about the fictional Nickel Academy unfold as the film develops, as time jumps reveal that years later, Elwood has been studiously researching the revelations that are coming to light about the abuse that he and his fellow students suffered at the hands of sadistic white quote-unquote educators acting more as wardens with unchecked power to abuse and kill. And I cannot say enough about Jomo Frey's cinematography or Nicholas Mansour's editing. I think both have set a new standard for contemporary filmmaking in the 2020s. But ultimately, it's Ramel Ross's use of archival documented footage from American history and film history alike that sets Nickel Boys apart and places it both within our current moment and across decades of history, as well as the cinematic canon. This has established Ross among the most promising directors in the world, and it will serve as a guiding light for the next generations of filmmaking, just like I said about Twin Peaks: The Return. The love he and Frey put into photographing the human face is both simple and masterful in its empathy, and to me is reminiscent of Jonathan Demme, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Barry Jenkins. I have not been stunned into silence by a movie like I was by this one in a very long time, and even though Nickel Boys is painful and at times unbearable to watch, I can tell that I will be returning to it for the rest of my life. Did you see this one?
I did, yeah. I liked it. Have you seen his previous work, Hale County, This Morning, This Evening?
I watched it recently. I sought it out after I saw Nickel Boys.
Cool. Did you like it?
I haven't seen it yet.
It's so funny. We come and do these lists and talk about the films that we've seen, and unfortunately, I can't see everything.
Neither can I.
And I just remember seeing Hale County This Morning, This Evening, and just not quite being able to see it in theaters when it came out in 2018.
Sure.
All right.
Number one. Here we go.
Okay, here it goes. Drum roll, please. Before I get to that.
That was more of a tongue roll.
I just want to bring up my number one from last year.
Okay.
I don't know why, because.
Sure, why not?
Just to start off, my film last year, which I absolutely adore, it's called Other People's Children. It's a film by Rebecca Zoltowski. It's about a late 30s, early 40s woman, school teacher, who is debating whether or not to have a child. She gets into a romantic relationship with a divorced man who has a young child. And so as their relationship heats up, she also becomes more attached to the child. She's also a school teacher, so it's other people's children that aren't hers. The main character, played by Virginia Efira. It's a deeply human film. And I bring that up because I named it my number one film last year, and I heard crickets from just about everyone else. No one said a word to me. No one's like, no one even said, I'll check it out. I'll look it up on Wikipedia or something. Nothing. Not a word about this wonderful film, Other People's Children. Now let's jump to 2024. Because I went to my gut, again, as I thought last year was Other People's Children and didn't hear a word from everybody, I named Trap by M. Night Shyamalan my number one film this year.
Let's go.
And boy, oh boy, did I hear it from people. People who I hadn't spoken to in years came out of the woodwork to be like, what the fuck are you talking about? And what's crazy is I'm not trying to... If you look at my list, we just went through the list, people. If you look at the list... I don't think I'm trying to be contrarian. I'm just trying to be true to myself. And the film I talked about most with people this year was Trap by M. Night Shyamalan. And so we talked about it briefly, I feel like, in one of our previous episodes.
We talked about it twice, I think, because you came on and we talked about the, you know, the time that you went to that Red Sox-Mets series where the Red Sox got trounced. And I think when we did that, you had just seen Trap and we ended up talking about it for a little bit.
Okay, cool.
And then also on our I don't remember which one it was, but another episode we did, we went into a very brief discussion about it. So we have discussed Trap already, but I'd love to keep talking about it.
Yeah, because that's kind of what I found myself saying is I saw a lot of wonderful movies, but time and time again, I kept asking people or telling people, hey, have you seen Trap? Let's talk about it. To me, Trap, we follow Josh Hartnett as this character called The Butcher. And he's taking his daughter to a concert, and we find that the concert is surrounded by the FBI and the Philadelphia Police Department because they know this serial killer played by Josh Hartnett named Cooper, his nickname is also The Butcher, is in the concert. So that kind of sets it all up for you. And to me, okay, so M. Night Shyamalan, to me, is the character The Butcher. And what he's asking is, can I be a Hollywood filmmaker and a good person? We see Josh Hartnett's character, Cooper the Butcher, at the concert with his daughter, and he is perpetually abandoning her and getting himself into situations, tough situations that he's trying to wiggle out of. Just as M. Night Shyamalan abandons his daughter and family to write twists and traps for his characters to get out of and make Hollywood movies. That's the number one thing M. Night Shyamalan loves in his life, his family and making movies. So the more M. Night Shyamalan spends time with his family doing what he loves, the less time he spends making his movies. And as we see with the Josh Hartnett character, as he's abandoning his daughter, not only is he a serial killer, but he's also just addicted to getting himself into dicey situations and getting out of them. And so this question of, can I be a Hollywood filmmaker and a good man? It reminds me of John Keats, who, if you don't know, he's a Romantic era poet. He had a family history of tuberculosis. He ended up caring for his mother, who died of tuberculosis. And after that, he was then diagnosed with tuberculosis. It's a contagious disease. And so the clock is running out on Keats much quicker than M. Night Shyamalan, of course. M. Night Shyamalan's living a long, healthy life as kids, everything like that. But the question is still the same. The more Keats spent with his love, Fanny Braun, the less time he spent writing poetry. And I think M. Night Shyamalan really, really likes making movies. And when he abandons his kids to make movies, that's brutal. But at the same time, he can make it up because he's M. Night Shyamalan. And he can do things like bring them backstage to their favorite pop concert, right? He's an A-lister. But is that enough? And so there's a lot of emotional moments in the film for me. And one of them, and again, how do I know? This is when it gets really on the nose, but why I like to say it is, Josh Hartnett's character's nickname is The Butcher, and what do butchers do? They hack people, and who has a reputation for being a hack filmmaker, right or wrong? It's M. Night Shyamalan. And so, but, you know, one of the moments that really gutted me in the film was when Josh Hartnett asks his daughter in the film, they see a trapdoor open, and I think Kid Cudi walks out of the trapdoor, and the door stays open, and Josh Hartnett says, hey, will you walk down this trapdoor with me? And his daughter's like, nah, I'm good. I just want to watch the concert. Now, if the serial killer is M. Night Shyamalan, and M. Night Shyamalan says, hey, Tony, do you want to walk down this trapdoor with me? I would say, of course, dude, you're M. Night Shyamalan. Let's fucking go down the creepy door, see what happens. How are you going to get me out of this, you know? But if I'm his kid, he's just dad. You know what? Not really dad, you know? Maybe he's taken him down trap doors before. So that's like brutal. It's kind of like when a comedian is popular the world over, but their kids don't find them funny at all. It's kind of brutal. And then, of course, another element in the third act, the much maligned third act, which I have no idea why. I think that's when the film gets most interesting. He has a sit down with his wife, Allison Pill, and she says to Josh Hartnett's character, I followed you one day, but all I saw was a room with a table and a chair. And, you know, it reminds me of, like, is it possible that M. Night Shyamalan's wife thought that he was maybe cheating on him at some point? This is just hypothetical, you know what I'm saying? Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But then she runs off and she's just like, oh, he just has an office he's been telling me about so he can have some quiet to write his screenplays. So I think it was a great studio film with a auteur filmmaker who's kind of laying his own dilemma bare for the world and audiences to see and explore with him. And yeah, I don't think M. Night Shyamalan is a hack filmmaker. And I also want to bring up that another filmmaker kind of in a similar vein named Alfred Hitchcock had a reputation at one point with being a hack filmmaker, by and large, by the pop culture of America. And that reputation was only changed by the French New Wave film critics who actually said, actually, he's not a hack, he's a genius, and here's why, as well as some other film critics like in the U.S., like Peter Bogdanovich. So, yeah, Trap is my number one film of the year.
That is an incredible description of Trap, man. I am so happy that you provided the listeners with that. I think that is a totally unique perspective on the film. And while I totally agree that I think it is a great like metaphor for M. Night's push and pull of his relationship being an artist and a director as well as a father to his kids, I had not gone so deep as you did into really like digging into that metaphor and trying to find, you know, even deeper meanings than on the surface.
And I will say, you know, it's interesting digging. I had only seen Signs prior. So I've never seen The Sixth Sense. I've never seen Unbreakable. I haven't seen the new stuff, old Split. Who's that knocking at the door? The Village, his much maligned Avatar movie, Lady in the Water. I haven't seen any of it. It all came clear to me and was hitting and firing on all cylinders from the jump of this movie. And I was there for the entire extraordinary ride.
Absolutely.
And shout out everybody in that film. Josh Hartnett.
Yeah, especially.
Alison Pill.
What a performance.
And his daughter, Salika Shyamalan, who's in on it as well. Like, yeah. I feel like she's a part of this dialogue with her dad.
Definitely.
Some a-holes were like, oh, he just made this movie so he could get his daughter's singing career off. Which is like kind of a funny thing to say because he is an A-list filmmaker. Like, that's like a legit thing. But I think they're more working together as partners in this exploration that his dad wants to explore. And she's obviously older now, so she might have an interest. She's 28, so maybe she has an interest in exploring these themes as an adult with her father.
Yeah, it's not exactly a JJ and Gracie Abrams situation.
I don't know what that means.
No, okay, well, JJ Abrams' daughter is like one of the big like pop star now.
Oh, she is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's okay. I think there's more meat on the bone in terms of the Shyamalan family than there is the Abrams family.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. On to my number one, the last movie to discuss today. And if you've listened to this podcast for a while, if you heard the episode we did on this film, or if you heard us talking about it last week in conversation about two of the director's other films, Nocturama and House of Tolerance, this should not surprise you at all that this is my number one selection on the list. I think it is far and away the best film of the year in a year that had really a lot of remarkable films to begin with. So I cannot shower enough praise on Bertrand Bonello's The Beast. Now, this is a movie that takes place in multiple time periods. It starts in the year 2044. Well, actually, that's not true. It starts with a green screen sequence in which we see Léa Seydoux, who the director has explicitly said is meant to be the actress and not her character, Gabrielle, standing in front of a green screen as we hear this sort of metaphorical tale inspired by a Henry James novella about the invisible beast and living in fear of this horrible monster that we cannot actually see and how that fear can potentially destroy our lives. That has so much to say about the actual text of the film as well, which that starts in 2024, where AI has taken over the world with the expressed intent to stop climate change, and by that time has apparently been successful, but in doing so has deemed human beings illogical and incapable of making emotional decisions, and therefore people are forced into this form of programming in which their emotions are removed entirely from their brain, and they're sort of just left as these mindless droids. We see this through Lea Seydoux's character, Gabrielle, as she is going through this processing, and in doing so is taking her through some of her past lives, whether that be in 1910 France or in 2014 Los Angeles. We see her repeated connection to character of Louis. She meets this character and he impacts her life in a non-reversible way in each of these different stories, as the two of them are sort of trying to save each other from losing their emotions forever and from having to live out the rest of their days in sort of an automated fashion determined to them by an AI. We did an entire episode on this film already, so you know, as I'm going to do with our episodes on Dune and Local Legends Bloodbath, I will link that below for a much longer description. But I mean, the reason that this impacted me so heavily and is truly, I think, an unforgettable film is, while you can never like define like the cultural footprint of the moment that you're currently living in, I think that the state of media criticism and the fact that there doesn't really seem to be a current pipeline for writers to reach the masses, whether that be venture capitalists buying and shuttering important media outlets, or the fact that social media platforms are censoring links to Patreon or Substack and neutering the outreach that independent media can have. I think one of the long-term effects of that will be that the 2020s will be defined by the relationship that they have to other decades and sort of our reimagining of some of that iconography of years past. And this film really is sort of a pastiche of so many of its other influences that I think that is going to hit particularly hard when people go back and they watch this film. You know, I mentioned Twin Peaks The Return in the context of I saw the TV glow. I think there are certain visual and thematic references in The Beast that are even more explicit in that case, namely because Bertrand Bonello actually listed Twin Peaks The Return on his Sight and Sound ballot back in 2022, where directors named the 10 greatest films of all time. So it isn't too much of a stretch to say that that had a huge impact on the work that he has put out since, like especially this film. But I don't know, even beyond that, like it feels like it's influenced by some of the structural experiments of Lost Highway or the degradation of new technology and its ability to create horrifying images like we see in Inland Empire. I mean, I also feel like the influence of last year at Marion Bad or Holy Motors, like we discussed a little bit earlier with Leo Carra. It's going to be a film that we talk about both in a vacuum because it's such an important work, but also in conversation with some of its influences, which it wears so heavily on its sleeve. I think in particular, the sequences that are set in 2014 Los Angeles are especially striking. The climax of that scene is the best scene of the year to me. And Bertrand Bonello, for a French director, his portrayal of America being like incels, computer viruses, some of which even named after Donald Trump, we even see him on Lea Seydoux's screen as her computer is getting fried. Soulless automation and Dasha Nekrasova, he fucking got our asses, dude. That's what America has become. Like, it's all trash humpers. It always has been. The Beast is my best film of 2024. That's going to do it for our top 10 movies of 2024. This has been a marathon conversation, and we thank any listeners who have stuck it out with us. We hope you enjoyed hearing our takes on these films. If you haven't seen them yet, hopefully you're inspired to go out and seek them out. And if you have seen them and you want to respond to anything that we said, feel free. Leave a comment below on Spotify. Hit us up on
Instagram.
Social media. I mean, yeah, whatever you want to do, man.
I'm at Tony Movies.
Absolutely. I am at Stuck in the Coil on Twitter. I am at Nolan R on Blue Sky, and Duck in the Coil Letterboxd as well. So hit us up to talk about some of these films. We would love to hear from some of the Mudville listeners. If you haven't heard yet, patreon.com/mudville. You can get free updates anytime we put out new content, whether that be a main feed episode from Brody Staub and I talking about baseball and film, or Mudville at the Movies, which you're hearing right now. We would like to do more of these episodes than we were able to put out last year. I think we're going to do our best to make that happen. But moving forward, we got a lot of fun content coming out there. I'm working on my first year player draft rankings right now for fantasy baseball. So if that's of any interest to you, highly recommend patreon.com/mudville. Be in the know anytime we put out something new. That's going to do it for... Oh, actually, before we get out of here, Tony, you were going to do your honorable mentions at the end of the episode. Do you have any for us?
My honorable mentions, do not expect too much from The End of the World. All We Imagine is Light. Indigo Girls, It's Only Life After All, which is a great documentary. You know, the night I saw The Beast, this is crazy, I was at the IFC Center and I was in line getting popcorn. This might not be PC, but I was like, seems like there are a lot of lesbians in the lobby right now. Just an honest observation. And then I was like, why could that be? And it was the Indigo Girls thing. And I was like, I love Indigo Girls. And I wish I didn't know it was a one-night-only screening, or else I would have been in the audience at the screening. And I was able to watch it on Netflix about a month or two later. And it is an astounding film that I would have put in my number 10 if I didn't want to use my number 10 to troll Nolan and Brody.
Ugh, it's messed up.
And so that's why that was left off to honorable mention. But it is a very revealing and reflective film. The Indigo Girls see a lot of the old clips of themselves live watching on an iPad, and then they give really honest reflections and critiques about themselves throughout their career. And I think the jarring honesty of them is the big draw there. And then one other film I want to highlight from 2024, actually a few others. Kneecap was a lot of fun. And Mars, which is a film, the final film by The Whitest Kids You Know. It's an animated comedy. If you liked The Whitest Kids You Know from the mid-2000s.
I certainly did.
It is a 10 out of 10 send-off for the entire troupe. And
rest in peace, Trevor Moore.
R.I.P. Trevor Moore. Trevor Moore forever and ever. Another thing, too, you can actually check out all their episodes and their sketches on YouTube, I think. I think it just streams 24/7 on YouTube. They have a channel. But I will say they have done a great job, I think, sprinting over the line of decency in comedy and taste and everything. But they're also human beings, and they have a real genuine love for everybody in humanity, and they're not punching down when they cross the line. And if they had in the past, they have a great disclaimer before their episodes from their old show, The Whitest Kids You Know. This is just separate to Mars, but it kind of puts it in a good historical context before you watch. And I think it's very smart of them to do that. And I appreciate that. So absolutely. I don't know where you can see Mars. I saw it at the Tribeca Film Festival. I hope it goes on tour. Maybe they put it on streaming somewhere. But it is very, very funny. And Trevor Moore goes down in flames in the film. It's very, very funny. So
I should also mention about The Whitest Kids You Know, one of their founding members, Zach Kreger, is the director of Barbarian,
yes,
which came out a few years ago, and he's currently working on what has been described as the Magnolia of Horror. So when that comes out, I'm very excited to see that.
Interesting.
Yeah, those guys are super talented, and I suppose I would not have expected that when I was watching The Grapist in 2011. All right, that's going to do it for us this week. That is our top 10 films of 2024. Mudville at the Movies is signing off. We hope you enjoyed. I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
And I'm Tony Brown.
And we'll see you guys next year.